In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, May 31st, 2013 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The very last Federal News Countdown of May 2013. And two experts in the world of the federal government are here to count down the most important news stories of the week as they have selected them. First, it's a veteran of the Federal News Countdown, Stan Soloway, President, CEO of the Professional Services Council. It's good to see you as always, my friend.
Always a pleasure.
And Stan, you have to be very nice this week because we have a new person on the Federal News Countdown. He's never done this before.
Woods is a real rookie, too.
So be very nice. It's Bob Woods, the president and founder of Topside Consulting. Bob, it's great to have you on the program
today.
Good
to be here.
You each have chosen the news stories that you think are the most important federal news stories of the week. We have them linked up at federalnewsradio.com later today, and we start the same place we always do with
number three.
Bob Woods, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from FCW, Federal Computer Week, and it's headlined, Representative Thompson Wants Better Answers from DHS on Spires. And I have to confess, I'm surprised that the whole Richard Spires issue at Homeland Security hasn't turned into a bigger deal than it has so far.
Well, I think there's a trend here. I mean, that's the reason I picked the story is when you start getting the kind of attention this is getting from the Hill over someone taking leave. And so, you know, in one sense, it's a very small story. But in another sense, the thing spiraled because it laid out there long enough and no answers came. And I contend that lack of information will sometimes create more activity than information. So there was nothing to kill the story. It kept growing. It kept expanding. The speculation actually grew the story. And at this point, we don't quite know what the whole story is. I think that's what Thompson's after.
We may find that out, though. The piece that I saw in this story that I didn't know before was Frank Kunkel writes, DHS Office of Inspector General conducted an investigation into Spires' situation around the time his leave began, March 15th. But the findings from that report have not been made public. And Congressman Thompson, the ranking member on the Homeland Security Committee, asking about this at the same time, wondering about exactly what Margie Graves, the acting CIO and the deputy there, what her status is. He wants answers about her biography, essentially, and that I thought was a little unusual.
Well, I think the train of thought seems to be, why did this person leave? Under what circumstances did they leave? And what's the qualifications of the person that took over after them? But I think still, this gets back to my premise that when you're dealing with Congress or oversight groups in general, you do it in small doses and you do it often. You don't wait a while. Remember, this thing stayed out there for a while. No information coming forward. Had information come forward in a timely manner, you wouldn't have this question.
The sense that I had from the initial response from DHS was that Jason Miller looked into this here at Federal News Radio. Other news outlets also did the same. And the response that we got was he's on leave. And as Frank writes here, was elected leave. He was just on vacation, taking time off. And you're right. No more came out about it. No more came out about it. And people started going, because
what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, he's chief information officer of one of the most important cabinet level agencies in the United States.
It looks like he disappears.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the next step is here, Bob? Where do you think this goes next? Is this something that you think piques the interest of anybody on the Republican side? Because right now it's just Congressman Thompson, the ranking member.
I think there's an aspect of this where it seems like it's meddling going on. But this is a case of form over substance. And at one point in my life, I got beat up by a committee member who said, why didn't you come up here and talk to us? And it was before I went to GSA, quite some time before I went to GSA. And I said, because I wasn't allowed to. I was told we're not going up. And we briefed him, and he was happy with what we were doing. He said, you seem to know what you're doing now that I see the details. And I said, well, so I guess this will go away. And he goes, no. you're going to get beat for a while, but for not coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is about.
Bob Woods' third most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is Representative Thompson wants better answers from DHS on spires. Stan Soloway, your third most important federal news story of the week contains a quote from someone who I find to be just one of the most qualified, intelligent, fantastic speakers.
That's why I chose the story.
On issues in the federal government. This story is from BNA. No, I'm sorry. This story is from
BNA.
Yes. The headline is Analysts Praise and Criticize DOD Proposal to Cap Allowable Compensation Costs. Federal contractors will face more difficulty recruiting highly skilled employees if Congress adopts the Defense Department's proposal to lower the cap on allowable contractor compensation. Professional Services Council President and CEO Stan Soloway told BNA May 24th.
Can you imagine?
Right in the very first paragraph of the story.
I actually did that just to get your goat a little.
Congratulations
bit.
On that.
Thank you.
Well
done. Succeeded.
Nicely done.
I actually chose this story because it seems to me we're spending an unseemly amount of time talking about an issue in completely the wrong context and diverting our attention from what's really important. And I think there's been so much misunderstanding and misinterpretation of what's going on here. It's worth actually setting the record straight because, in fact, this is all taking place against the backdrop of the civil service getting beat up mercilessly, many of them facing 15% and 20% pay cuts, and OMB's furloughing again on Monday. DOD started their furlough notices this past week, and they're going 11 days. And so when you juxtapose that against what goes on in the private sector, where employers are trying to, for some degree of normalcy, to hold on to their workforces and so forth, it creates a fairness perception and leads you to this sort of a bunch of populist rhetoric that actually is rather disingenuous and silly, but understandable given the environment. The facts of the matter are this has actually changed even since this story came out the other day. As of yesterday, and you all reported it here, OMB is now asking for a cap across all government and all government contractor employees of $400,000 and of the allowable costs. And they're saying we're doing that because nobody should get paid more than the President of the United States. And there's been so much rhetoric around that. I just thought, let's understand exactly what's taking place here. First of all, for years, there has been a cap on what is allowed to be paid or allowed to be billed to the government in cost-type contracts for the top five most highly paid executives in a company. And the purpose of the cap is to say, we want the companies to get really good executives. We don't want bad executives running our contractors, but we don't want to pay these egregious compensation packages that we sometimes see in the private sector. So Congress passed this law. There's a formula set up by Congress that OMB implements each year to determine what that cap should be. The problem is the formula, the cap has gone up unusually quickly the last few years because we have seen a handful of outliers in the commercial world, these exorbitant packages that bring the averages up. So the discussion for the last couple of years has been this is not working quite right. And we and everybody else in industry has said, we get it. You could freeze the cap for a couple of years, figure this out, decide if the formula is right, we need to change it. Understood. Now we have this all applied to all employees at DOD, and under the president's proposal, it will be applied to all employees doing contractor work across government. Employees who are doing the work are a whole different kettle of fish. They're not making that kind of money, so it's not an entitlement, as some people like to act, that they're making all this dough. But companies have to be able to go out and compete in the workforce, particularly for technology talent that often is far more expensive than the government pays its people, let alone what the government wants to be able to pay. It's where the industry is the conduit to that talent. Just a piece today in the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was, that talked about the biggest battle for talent today is between Wall Street and the technology community for computer science and technology talent. That's the world in which these companies are also competing. And so no company is going to pay more than it needs to pay, a penny more for talent, because they won't be competitive. But they also have to have the flexibility to get who they would need, what they think they need to deliver excellence for the customer. So we've conflated two different issues. Finally, the third piece here is that we've now said we're going to cut the cap in half to $400,000, which is it's now just under $800,000, because of the president's salary. Well, the president's salary is $400,000, but we're not talking about salary here. We're talking about total compensation. So if you did the same measure against the president's salary, you'd be in the millions because you'd have to add things like food and travel and housing and security and all that kind of stuff. So it's sort of a ludicrous comparison, apples to oranges anyway. More importantly, it has nothing to do with the issue. The president, the vice president, members of Congress, salaries are not set based on anything to do with the commercial marketplace where people are competing for talent. It's an entirely different environment.
All right. The thing, the hump that I think you might get over, and you've covered this, you and I have talked about this issue a number of times before, and we don't have time to talk about it today, and I would love to have you come back and continue this at some point in a different venue. But it strikes me that based on what some of the other groups that are in favor of this are saying, the hump you've got to get over is explaining to people why it makes sense for the government to reimburse companies for these executive salaries when, for example, if I'm a company in the private sector and I buy a service from another company, I pay them whatever I pay them for that service, and there's not a rider in the contract, at least not that I'm aware of, that I'm going to give you an extra bit of money to help pay for your salary. And whether that's a misconception or not, I'm not here to argue with you about.
This is something that people misunderstand. It's a great point, and I'll cover it very quickly because I know we can't get into detail.
I got 30 seconds.
The fact of the matter is that this is, in the government marketplace, is the only place in commerce today where we actually say to a company, we're going to question whether we're even going to pay all of your costs. And so this is not an extra. This is built into your corporate overhead as it would be in any pricing scheme you would have in the commercial world. Only in the government do you actually have to break it out into pieces.
Right.
And so for the contracts that this covers, for the employees who are doing the work, the government already has total cognizance over what they're getting paid, and they determine if it's fair and reasonable. So we don't even need a cap. This is built into every company's, every organization's, nonprofit or for-profit overhead. And this is the one place in commerce where we're going to say, well, maybe we're not going to let you have what it really costs.
All right. We're going to continue that conversation at some point in the future, Stan, because I think it is important. Stan's third most important federal news story of the week is headline, Analysts Praise Criticize DOD Proposal to Cap Allowable Compensation Costs. It's from BNA. And you can read it and all of our stories linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. More Federal News Countdown in just a moment.
Ligia Ricciardi, Director, Office of Consumer eHealth, Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, on the Improving Healthcare Outcomes Through IT Policy Panel, sponsored by HIMSS.
Another thing that we learned from the Beacons was a really interesting research project done at Geisinger, through which patients were given online access to their own health information, and just by looking at their medication lists alone, so a list of what medications you're on average, people were able to identify two errors or omissions per person.
To hear the full conversation, visit federalnewsradio.com. If you're a healthcare policy leader, IT professional, or provider struggling to meet new health policy requirements with fewer resources, HIMSS, focused on better health through information technology, invites you to the Government Health IT Conference and Exhibition on June 11th and 12th. Don't miss this opportunity to share successes, challenges, and solutions with your peers from government, technology, and healthcare communities. Register today at govhealthitconference.com.
Giving you the edge on healthy living, here's Mayo Clinic Medical Edge. Lots of studies have shown the powerful effect that exercise can have on cancer care and recovery. But many cancer patients are reluctant to exercise, and few discuss it with their oncologists.
Patients with late-stage cancer are not getting adequately counseled to enable them to stay strong and as fit as possible as they go through treatment.
Those were the findings of a study led by Mayo Clinic Dr. Andrea Chevelle. She says laying off the physical exercise creates a snowball effect.
If you feel worsening fatigue, worsening shortness of breath, perhaps pain when you exercise, not doing anything is a way of not feeling your symptom. But the downside of not moving is that little by little the body gets weaker and it gets less and less able to do even normal activities.
For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Tracy McRae.
This is Lifelines from NIH Radio. Here's Dr. Tonya Agours-Collins from the National Cancer Institute.
To many, cancer remains one of the most frightening diagnoses in modern medicine. But much of this fear is a result of myths that have circulated for years in spite of the good information that is available. Some of the most common cancer myths not only cultivate false ideas and fears, but also can interfere with how people think and behave when facing cancer in themselves or in a loved one. Myth: cancer is a death sentence. The fact is, more than 12 million cancer survivors are living in the United States. Thanks to improved treatments and earlier diagnosis of some cancers, more than 3 of every 5 cancer patients are alive 5 years after their diagnosis.
Lifelines from NIH Radio, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. Former IRS Commissioner Mark Everson joins us with what's next for that troubled agency and what the acting commissioner, Danny Werfel, has to do. Plus, Federal News Radio's Jason Miller did a deep investigation of cybersecurity at Veterans Affairs. You won't want to miss his hard-hitting report. Those stories and much more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Stan Soloway and Bob Woods, and we're up to
number 2.
And Bob, your second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is, how hard will Lisa Jackson pressure Apple's suppliers on the environment? Lisa Jackson, of course, former EPA administrator, now going from the East Coast to the West Coast to work for Apple as their head of environmental affairs. And what do you see here as the kind of, I guess, people use the term insider knowledge as some nefarious thing, but it's not in this case. She knows every letter in detail, you would think, of environmental policy and procedure, and she's going to take that now to Apple. What does that gain for the company, do you think?
I think Apple's working on their image, and I wouldn't take it to the limit of saying they're polishing the apple, but they are.
I wish I had a buzzer, a DJ buzzer.
Well, their problem is there's an image problem.
Mm-hmm.
They've just had their CEO in front of Congress. They've got all kinds of spinoff issues, environmental issues from the downstream suppliers. I think all of a sudden you're the most valuable company in the world. You're in the limelight now. You're not able to hide in the weeds. You can't deny that you know anything about these supply chains. And now all of a sudden this is coming out. I think what they're trying to do with Lisa Jackson is to build credibility, that they're taking the issue seriously. Now, the question here, which the article raises, is how much rope is she going to be given to fix it? Can she be brutally honest, or will this be we must be doing well because we hired the head of the EPA? So we'll see what comes of it. Is this just a spin kind of thing, or is this the real thing? Are they taking it seriously?
Stan, as I looked at Bob's stories and saw this one in particular, it occurred to me that Apple as a company, I'm not an Apple groupie like some people that I know, and I don't begrudge them that. But this reminded me of some of the same kind of coverage that Apple got between Jobs' first tenure and second tenure as the leader of that company. And I wonder if we're not in another. I mean, he certainly can't come back for a third time, so they're kind of.
Well, some people are afraid he will.
they're certainly in a spot.
Yeah, I think that's true. I thought this was a fascinating story. I know we're going to talk more about Apple later on again, but what struck me with what Bob was just saying, which I think is absolutely true, is that we're going through a phase now where some of the, and I want to be careful how I put this. I am, by the way, an Apple groupie. I've all Mac stuff, but we're going through a phase now that actually started when I read Walter Isaacson's book about Steve Jobs, which was very interesting in terms of the brilliance of the man, but also interesting in terms of the character or quality of lack thereof of the man. And I've had this conversation with my daughters, who are all in their 20s or early 30s, and this is, I think we're going through a phase where the, quote, new technology companies now are being seen as, well, these have become very large companies. They have all the same warts of every other company. And if you took away the iconic nature of their product, they're like the robber barons or the steel magnates and so forth in terms of exorbitant amounts of money. They have environmental issues. They've got labor issues, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And you realize it's iconic as it may be. And that may have been Jobs' greatest strength, as he was able to maintain this iconic image.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, when you get below the surface, which Isaacson did so brilliantly in mm-hmm. his book, you find out that it's a company. It happens to make, I think, great products, but it has all the same challenges and problems anybody else does in business or anyplace else.
Mm-hmm.
These are not the harmless geeks that we start out with, at least image-wise.
Well, and there's a parallel in our community to this, too, because I hear all the time, and Stan and Bob, you both have run into this in your careers, where the transition from the entrepreneur who starts the company to the business leader who can run the company and turn it from, you know, the entrepreneur can make it a $0 to $5 million company, but can't make it a $50 million company.
That's
a different person. And so I see the same thing here as far as the next person who's going to make Apple, whatever it is next, is going to be completely different than Jobs. It may not be Tim Cook. And as you're right, we'll talk about this, Stan, later on in the hour. But we don't know what that person's skill set's going to be or who that person's going to be.
But I think Bob's point about it being under the radar and no longer under there has to do with its iconic nature growing up. And it just sort of, this is the coolest thing on the planet. Mm-hmm. Google has issues. Facebook has issues. Microsoft had its issues several years ago. And I think what we realize, I'm not criticizing companies. I mean, this is the nature of business, has all kinds of complexities to it. And it's, your product is one thing, but the behaviors behind the scene are always going to be in question. And I think that you just find out that, yeah, nice products, but it's a company with a lot of problems and a lot of challenges.
The other part of this that fascinates me is we're how long now into the United States capitalist experience, and these issues that happen over and over again to companies over and over again seem to always hit people hard right between the eyes. I mean, they look not prepared for them. For these kinds of challenges. Is that a fair estimation?
Well, it's
fair, on that
part? Because you went from being a cool company, as Stan says, in which it was almost a cult-like following. I went to some of the early Apple World conferences, and, I mean, there was not only a fervor there. These guys did not dress at Brooks Brothers. They were an odd-looking group. It was closer to Woodstock than it was to Brooks Brothers. And then you go from that and all the talk about starting in a garage, and all of a sudden it's Stan saying you're the world's most valuable company, and people are going through your garbage. They're checking on you. They're taking pictures of you. So don't leave a message to follow me around, because you'll find out they will.
We'll dig into this a little bit more, as Stan mentioned, later on in the hour. Bob Woods' second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is, How Hard Will Lisa Jackson Pressure Apple Suppliers on the Environment? You can read it and all of our stories later on in the hour at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important story from Stan Soloway next on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
At BAE Systems, we always focus on keeping troops safe. One challenge military pilots face, it's called a brownout. When helicopter pilots confront dust storms or fog, the risk of collision is much higher. That's why we created a technology that lets pilots see terrain and obstacles through these conditions. Knowing our work helps to save lives inspires us every day. We'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
Ask the CIO is brought to you by CenturyLink.
Steve Van Roekel is the Federal Chief Information Officer. He says the new open data executive order and policy are creating an environment to unlock information to change the perception of government.
And I think there is an aspect of this that is going to be about how do we build community around government data? How do we gather new data? How do we triangulate existing data in a way that can create value?
Listen to Ask the CIO Thursday mornings at 10:30 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM or anytime on federalnewsradio.com.
It looks like the forecast is calling for a whole new cloud. Brought to you by CenturyLink. Get a visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions with CenturyLink, all built on a global, secure, carrier-grade network. And their custom solutions and support models are designed to enhance your efficiency every day of the week. Let their cloud infrastructure blanket you with security. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
For over a century, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio. Teens in Profile. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Teenage girls may want to take a look in the virtual mirror. Your profile picture, bio, and interests might say more about you than you want. A study looked at the social media behaviors of girls ages 14 to 17, how they presented themselves, and their likelihood to interact with people they met online. Dr. Jenny Knoll is a professor of pediatrics at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center.
The girls who had the propensity to present themselves as provocative online were the ones who met someone offline.
Teenage girls should think two or three times before seeing someone they met online.
For an adolescent female to meet someone offline whose identity has not been fully confirmed is a dangerous situation.
The study in the journal Pediatrics was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
Regardless of a few federal event cancellations, did you know there are hundreds of other government and military events happening right here in the D.C. metro area? Conferences, expos, and training events focusing on defense, cybersecurity, IT, and more are taking place right here, right now. GovEvents.com is the place to go to find out what's happening and where it's happening. Visit GovEvents.com to sign up for your free membership today.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Bob Woods and Stan Soloway. And Stan, your choice at number two is Jason Miller's story, headlined Former OMB Performance Guru Metzenbaum Lands New Job. She's taken the head job at the Volcker Alliance, which is a new nonprofit based in New York City. And it will be, Jason writes, the alliance's effort to improve the effectiveness of government at all levels. What jumped out at you about this beyond the fact that Shelley is once again gainfully employed, which makes Kelman very happy?
Right, exactly, and a friend of many, many years.
Yes.
I actually chose this because I wanted Jason to feel a little love. But I chose this not as much just about Shelley. There was another story earlier that week about Volcker forming this new group, and it reminded me that it wasn't too many years ago, maybe half dozen or 8 years ago, that Paul Volcker headed up a commission looking at the future of the civil service. And one of their prime conclusions was that we were trying to run a 21st century government with a mid-20th century structure.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some very powerful and, I thought, compelling insights into what change is needed in government. And I admired the fact that at his age, he's coming back at this again with a vengeance. He brought Shelley in, who I think is one of the smartest people I've ever known in government. She wasn't just at OMB. In the Clinton administration, when I was in government, she was at EPA. And obviously, as you said, Steve Kelman was at OMB. But then there are others like Donna Shalala and others who are Alice Rivlin, some real smart thinkers part of this. And what it says to me, their mission aside, is they're on the right track. I mean, with the budget crisis we have, which isn't going anywhere, this is both a crisis and an opportunity. And it's an extraordinary opportunity to really transform government. We have a complete changeover in the workforce is going to take place, natural attrition over the next 5 to 10 years. We have a budget crisis. We have a technology explosion that we could take advantage of. So if somebody smart's really thinking about how we can change government, I'm all for it. And I think it's great that Shelley's gone there and continue to apply her efforts. But it wasn't an advertisement for her. It was an advertisement for what they're trying to mm-hmm. do and how important it is at the moment.
And Stan's exactly right about that, Bob. The yeah. issue that I saw with this is I wonder, and this is no reflection on Shelley's capability, which is tremendously high, mm-hmm. but what's to make us think that this effort will be different than other efforts that have been, shall we say, not as productive?
Well, I think Paul Volcker himself has regrets about the commission. I just read some material of his, and when he says schools that have public administration curricula don't really know what they want, that they really are talking public policy, not public administration, and that no one's worried about how the system works. Everybody wants to talk about policy. No one wants to talk about how do you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as an engineer, we used to argue all the time with architects. Architects and engineers have a famous ongoing battle. Architects come up with a dream. We come up with having to figure out how the thing's going to stand up and not fall down. And I think no one's worrying about the engineering, the public administration part of this. And I think Volcker himself's got regrets. Mm-hmm. And he's come back at this because of that, because he doesn't feel like the things the commission looked at were taken seriously, and that years later we don't have much to show for
it. And another way to look at your question, Francis, and Bob hit it on the head, but I think another way to look at your question is, if people like this don't do this, what happens?
Right.
And so will this be the answer? Right. Probably not. But the more people with the degree of respect that Alice Rivlin and Donna Shalala, Tom Davis, Paul Volcker, Shelley, with teams like that, and there are others, are really focused on what we could do to improve government, given the environment we face and the numerous layers of challenges, the better chance there is something will give.
It does strike me, too, that somebody with Shelley's background, especially the immediacy of her experience and background, she knows which buttons to push to get information into and out of the system as it exists today.
It's also more than an academic exercise. It's mm-hmm. a very current exercise. I mean, Volcker's been out of office for a number of years. Alice Rivlin's been very active and one of the leaders on the budget, but she's not been in government for a long time. Shelley's very current. And you put those powers together, and you've got a pretty effective team.
Well, Shelley and Steve are both blessed with that kind of talent. Mm-hmm. That it is quite a couple when you look at their ability to get things done. And I think Volcker's been very smart to hire her.
Shelley's a better dresser, though.
That's
than
true.
Steve.
That's
God.
Steve, if you're listening, we still love you. Former OMB performance guru Metzenbaum lands new job is Stan Soloway's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown. All the stories that we are talking about are linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're at the top of the chart. The most important story is selected by Stan Soloway and Bob Woods when we continue on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Join me this Saturday at 10 o'clock for Power of Attorney here on 1500 AM. This week, I'll be discussing tax issues that commonly arise during a divorce, and my special guest is Ms. Erin Smith of Raymond James Financial Services, who will discuss financial mistakes to avoid during a divorce. Power of Attorney is sponsored by the full-service law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, taking pride in working together with our clients, fully invested in their success. For more information about the show, visit us on the web at powerofattorneyradio.com.
Kick off summer at the Safeway Barbecue Battle June 22nd and 23rd to benefit the Boys and Girls Clubs. 30 bands on three stages, including the Wailers and Roy Ayers on the Pepsi Next Lay soundstage, and Kristen and the Noise and EU on the Famous Dave's music stage. Free food in Safeway's Sampling Pavilion, the National Pork Barbecue Championship, Ranchers Reserve Beef Contest, Purdue Sizzlin' Chicken Contest, plus NBA Nation, and lots more. Easy to get to by metro. Visit bbqdc.com.
Botched predictions on federal retirement breathed life into the idea of a so-called retirement tsunami, but it has never materialized, leaving the government instead to deal with a slow leak. Federal News Radio's special report, Retirement Conundrum, investigates what led to the faulty forecast, why OPM has trouble reducing the retirement claims backlog, and how agencies retain institutional knowledge as longtime employees walk out the door. Retirement Conundrum, only on federalnewsradio.com. Search retirement.
Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Jessica Wright is acting Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness.
For every dollar that we use from a furlough, we can benefit the readiness and our mission capability, and that's DOD's mission. So the fact of the matter is the furloughs will happen. We are looking clearly at whether or not we can work through a decision to limit it.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The three most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown are selected on today's edition by Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Bob Woods of Topside Consulting. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, and we talked about Apple earlier in the program. Bob, your most important story of the week is headline, Apple CEO Cook testifies before Senate panel after report says it avoids billions in taxes. And this fits with what we talked about earlier in a number of different ways, but why did you go with this one at number one this week?
Well, some of it might have been pure sympathetic. I looked at Cook's picture in front of the hearing. And I thought to myself, I thought I was better looking when I was testifying. but probably not. And I think the issue here is that here's a company becoming the most valuable in the world now, and the limelight's not hasn't been kind so far. That they're beginning to look behind the covers. They're beginning to see a company avoiding taxes. I think the whole corporate tax issue is one that Congress needs to address. But calling a CEO who came in voluntarily to come in to rake him over the coals because he's obeying the laws they passed seems a bit ironic to me. And I think that what you have to understand, though, is this is the pragmatics of it. We're going to have to deal with that. Apple's limelight is going to produce looks at them that they never imagined. And, you know, if you saw the movie about Howard Hughes and being in front of those congressional hearings in a hostile environment is no damn fun, I can tell you. It's just not something you look forward to.
This discussion about Apple, Stan, I think maybe 5 years ago, wouldn't have mattered much in the scope of the federal business world because Apple's market share at that time, I mean, if it was possible to have a negative market share, it might have been negative. Their technology, their innovation with the iPad and the iPhone have pretty much changed that. And, I mean, you know, you can't go to one of your member meetings, and I can't go to any kind of federal event without seeing at least half the audience carrying some kind of Apple technology. You have yours. Is yours an iPad, Bob?
iPad, yeah.
All right. So two out of three of us in this room have them on them. And so this becomes an entirely different thing. The future of Apple as a company and the vagaries of what they go through managing that company become very important in our space all of a sudden.
Well, they do become important in the government space because they are now starting to play with the tablets and the mobile computing, and they are growing market share. I had a slightly different take, though, on this story, and I don't disagree with anything that's been said, but my slightly different take was, in a way, perhaps unplanned. For those who were in favor of corporate tax reform, this was a brilliant strategy to bring in an iconic company as opposed to an oil company or an insurance company, which everybody likes to beat up every day of the week, and to show that they are, in fact, obeying the law. But I think it's unrealistic to think people are going to sort of voluntarily, you know, give up resources, whether they're individually. I don't know about you, Princess. I typically don't pay extra taxes. I mean, I pay my taxes, but
yes,
I don't pay extras.
I pay them accurately, but I pay.
You pay what they ask.
Well, only what they ask.
But bringing an iconic company, and again, putting them in the same category as sort of the rest of the international business community raises questions about how do we approach corporate tax reform, but how do we also approach the whole question of globalization, which also ties back to the Lisa Jackson story, which is an issue we've been dealing with other kinds of industries, oil, other exploration and environmental industries, because there are different rules, different standards, whether it's labor, environmental, health, and so forth around the world. And then what's our role in and of that? And now we're looking at Lisa Jackson's looking at Apple's green policies and its carbon footprint worldwide, not just within regard to U.S. policy. This also ties into that same network of issues of it's a great example of globalization, which we all know exists, technology we know is global. And now we're coming face to face with some of the practical issues. And I think in some ways it was clever to have Apple be the one up, because now it says, all right, this is a company everybody really kind of loves. How do we deal with this? And what is the answer? Because as Bob said, he's obeying the law Congress passed.
Well, let's suppose that it wasn't countries. Let's suppose the state of Virginia had 12% tax, which Ireland has, and Maryland had 38. How many companies would be in Maryland?
Mm-hmm.
Or reverse that. It doesn't matter. But suppose it was two states that did this.
Well, it happens every day. Between the states,
people drive for differences in gasoline taxes, which on 15 gallons, how much can it bring you?
Yeah,
put that up against what we're dealing with here, and we're talking billions. What they have not talked a lot about is the amount of money that is stranded in these countries that you can't take out unless you pay tax at the new rate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just that the money's in Ireland; it's that the money's staying in Ireland. It's not coming back here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's causing those kinds of problems. And again, Stan, I agree with your point. And maybe it was brilliant to bring in somebody that was less of the easy-to-hate companies.
I didn't even think of that a possibility, Stan, until you raised that. But that is interesting.
It's too Machiavellian, but it struck me when I looked as a better than having Shell Oil there.
No, on second glance, I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's almost too obvious that I'm kicking myself that I didn't see it up front, because there are folks that are not enamored of Apple, and I'm one of those, but I don't hate them. There's nothing about them that I think anywhere in the population raises any kind of dissonance, as you say, with if this had been, you know, ExxonMobil or Shell or one of the big petroleum companies, or and you could name a thousand of them, that there's some element of the population that doesn't like them for whatever reason, and that's not the case with this particular company. Where does this go, do we think? How might this be the first kind of salvo in some kind of tax reform effort?
This is international competition and globalization at its finest, and the U.S. is going to have to compete. We can't sit around with 38% tax rates and compete against countries that are 12%. If we were 18%, we would draw a lot of business back to this country, but this is one of those things that we're going to get serious, or we hurt the country in general. This is not a party issue, although right now I think it has party aspects to it.
I actually am a member of the club now that I think of it. As you were talking, Bob, I pulled my iPhone out of my pocket, so I don't have my iPad. I don't have a tablet with me, but I've got the iPhone.
Yep.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Bob Woods, is Apple CEO Cook testifies before Senate panel after report says it avoids billions in taxes. It's on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, the link there. And Stan Soloway's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is next on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
The CIO is brought to you by CenturyLink.
Steve Van Roekel is the federal chief information officer. He says the new open data executive order and policy are creating an environment to unlock information to change the perception of government.
And I think there is an aspect of this that is going to be about how do we build community around government data? How do we gather new data? How do we triangulate existing data in a way that can create value?
Listen to Ask the CIO Thursday mornings at 10:30 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM or anytime on federalnewsradio.com.
Let's get down to brass tacks. There's nothing more important than trust. CenturyLink offers cybersecurity solutions to the government. And the Department of Homeland Security has approved CenturyLink to provide enhanced cybersecurity services to critical infrastructure entities to keep you efficient and secure. As your trusted technology partner, their visionary cloud infrastructure, global broadband network, along with custom communication solutions and responsive dedicated support, provide the scalable solutions you need 24/7, 365. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Pay inequality between men and women in the federal ranks is getting some attention from President Barack Obama. He's asked the Office of Personnel Management to examine whether current agency practices contribute to pay inequality. The agency has also been tasked with formulating a government-wide strategy to tackle the pay gap. Agencies will have 90 days to provide OPM with their current policies for determining starting salaries for new feds. Currently, females in government make an average of 11 cents less than their male counterparts.
The year was 1943. In the dark days of World War II, WEPA, a nonprofit association, was formed to provide life insurance to civilian employees serving covertly overseas. 70 years later, in a time of sequestration and furloughs, WEPA is still protecting federal employees and their families with lower premium rates, a premium refund policy, and a college scholarship program for their children. Visit WAEPA.org to learn how to protect your family and save your hard-earned money. Again, that's WAEPA.org.
What is GSA's Public Building Service doing to enhance the management of its real estate portfolio? What kinds of investments are being made to repair and maintain the nation's public buildings? How is PBS better using government-owned space, making federal real estate smaller and more efficient? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Dorothy Robine, Commissioner, Public Building Service, U.S. General Services Administration, on the next The Business of Government Hour.
Register today to attend a firm's Executive Leadership Awards Luncheon on June 13th to applaud senior executives from the public sector. Gather with leaders from across government as a firm honors the achievement of 14 public sector innovators. Join them Thursday, June 13th at 11:30 a.m. at the Capitol Hilton in Washington, D.C. Register today at www.affirm.org. That's affirm.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, selected by Bob Woods and Stan Soloway. And Stan, your most important federal news story of the week is from The Atlantic. The headline is, "What Would It Mean for Governments to Compete Like Businesses?" And this piece goes through the idea that we've talked about on this program a number of times, that we should run government like a business. I think in our world, just about everybody understands that doesn't make sense. That's not possible for a number of different reasons. But I'm curious why this jumped out at you in the environment that we live in right now and the way the landscape looks, why you think this is the most important thing of the week.
Well, it came out of The Atlantic, and what struck me about the article, because I think you're right, and the author even says governments cannot be run like businesses, they're not businesses. We tend to be today in a world of either or. People saying it should be all run like a business and so forth, or others saying, no, it's government's a government and we want it to be run completely in an antithetical way, a manner antithetical to business. What the author here posits is there is a marriage of the two that you have to do if you're going to survive and create the environment and society that you want, so that governments typically compete on cost, the race to the bottom and so forth, but actually quality really matters in critical ways, not just for the government's delivery, but in terms of society at large, in terms of the quality of education. So what I thought the author did in a fairly concise manner, because it's not a very long article, is make the case that you can be run like a business and not be a business and adopt. And he actually makes the point very early in the article. Says governments may not be businesses and they may not be run like businesses, but they and we need to think of them like businesses in order successfully to confront the challenges, the possible new product lines, potential competitors, and economic constraints that governments face across the world today and in the future. And I think that's actually a fairly insightful statement. It's not you are a business. You don't adopt all of the principles of business. You have no profit margin and so forth. But there are quality and innovation and other goals government needs to have, or they're not going to be. And he makes an unfortunate comparison later on, but about you can end up sort of in a third world environment or a first world environment. And that's the difference between marrying quality and innovation or just going with a sort of a cost focus. And I don't mean that in an acquisition sense. I mean it in a broader context. And so what we see in government today is exactly the antithesis of that. And one of the things that we see throughout the budget crisis is the government making short-term balance sheet decisions that are absolutely clearly going to drive long-term costs. Companies that have done that end up going under. It's a hard thing not to do in any environment, but smart companies that have sustainability, that actually continue to innovate and grow, are the ones that know how to balance that out. It's not all about overinvesting, but if you underinvest, you pay the price. And I think that's part of the point that the author is making, is about investment of all kinds, the term in a very broad sense.
Bob, when we see government try to do things the way they work in the private sector, there's a consistent pattern of them not working. Now, the reasons can vary from item to item, but a couple of them that jumped out at me while Stan was talking were performance-based pay, not just at the Defense Department, but other places in government, didn't work. The Internal Revenue Service privatized for a period of time some of their debt collection process. They've done that on a number of occasions, and it's never stuck because the rate of return that they get is worse than what they do internally. How do we get out of that cycle of just not getting it for whatever reason?
I would change the wording a little bit. I would say more like use business methods as appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
When you say like a business, it sounds like you've got every aspect of it. The Harvard studies between the B school and the government school says that the typical large decision in government has about 75 factors that have to be considered. A large, important decision in the industry side takes between 25 and 30. Well, that doesn't mean that those 25 or 30 aren't important and that you shouldn't be proficient in those issues, But you can't forget the other 45. You have to go across the spectrum. And so, you know, I took a GSA when in my time there. We wanted to run that like a business as much as we knew how. We worried about expense in the chain. We worried about sales. We worried about where we were serving the customer, whether we met their mission needs. But at the same time, I didn't get part of the surplus to take home with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Yeah, and I think, Bob, just the two things he just said are critical. And the GSA example is a great one because that was essentially a revolving, a working capital fund. It was actually set up to be like a business.
Mm-hmm.
But, Francis, I actually challenge your premise. I think that for every example, whether in the IRS tax collection or performance-based pay, which is a whole different issue, that's as much a political issue as it is a management issue.
Okay.
So we'll stay with that. But my point would be that we have dozens more examples where business elements and business discipline and business acumen has been brought to bear, particularly competition, that actually has repeatedly demonstrated itself. I remember years ago, we used to have all those debates about A76 and competitive sourcing and so forth. The one thing we knew for absolute certain, one of the few numbers I was ever allowed to use when I was at the Defense Department because we could prove it, was the competition was what drove the improved performance and the lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true in any environment. So there are disciplines of business, and that's what this author is getting at, that there are basic business disciplines
right. That
do not make you a business, but make you run smarter and make you run better.
And you used the word that I was hoping we would get to in this conversation, which is the root of the issues when there are issues, like the examples that I mentioned, more often than not, strikes me, turn out to be political, that don't have to do with the execution in the executive branch. They have to do with either the planning or the execution or the oversight from the legislative branch.
It can be, but it can also be political on the executive side. I mean, there's a variety of factors. It's not an either or. We've seen plenty of cases where really good programs were pretty well destroyed for political reasons because it didn't serve the purposes of one interest group or another. But let's just say that politics plays a much bigger role in the execution and success of anything government does than it does in the business world. That's probably 63 of the 75 factors.
Probably. But the thing I would say is the politics do play in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to use competition, you got to account for the politics.
Stan Soloway's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from The Atlantic. The headline, "What Would It Mean for Governments to Compete Like Businesses?" It and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown are linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Bob, a fantastic debut on the Federal News Countdown. It's great to have you on the program.
Well, look who I started with.
That's just right. And Stan, great to see you as always, my friend. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Francis.
Hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose is next, and our program's archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.